Welcome to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I'm Deb Coviello, and as the Drop-In CEO, I drop into businesses and assume the CEO role to mitigate crises and help teams get back on track. This podcast is about helping the C-suite leader to navigate challenges with confidence. For today's leader, I'm here to help you get back on track. Tomorrow's leader, let me partner with you to learn the secrets of the C-suite. Wherever you're at in your career, this is the podcast for you. Hello, I am Deb Coviello, the Drop-In CEO, and I want to thank you for joining us on another episode where I have the good fortune week after week to speak to amazing leaders who share their insights with you. And if you love this episode, and I know you will, please do me a favor, tell at least one other person about this amazing resource so we can elevate others around us. And just know I do this podcast for the C-suite leader of today and tomorrow because I want you to navigate your challenges, your opportunities with confidence through these insights. And it is with great pleasure that we have on the show Daniel Pinkham, who is the CEO and principal consultant of Lakehurst Consulting. And he has over 30 years of industry experience as a proven operational leader, building and guiding teams in operations, engineering, asset care, OpEx, project management, and health and safety at both the site and the corporate levels. He has practiced in numerous industries, medical device, food machinery manufacturing, private equity, et cetera, so many things. And also to top it off, he's got an MBA from Marshall University, a BS in chemical engineering from the University of Maine, and is also, like me, a certified Lean Six Sigma Black Belt. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Deb. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it is a pleasure because for my audience, when Dan and I met each other, we got to talking. We are cut from the same cloth. We want to make things better, faster, cheaper, safer. We are both practicing continuous improvement consultants, and we're just here to help businesses be more profitable, be more efficient, and help people struggle less. So I want to just definitely delve into his story and his unique value. But Dan, I want to give you the floor first and share a bit about yourself personally and how you arrived at this work.
Thanks, Deb. As I think most people who end up in this type of functional work, it goes back to education and growing up. So I grew up around entrepreneurs. My parents, in addition to being school teachers, had a couple of businesses they owned on the side, one of which I'm now a part owner of. So I have another business as well, and it's a hospitality business on the coast of Maine. We rent out cottages, so have the family business experience. Growing up, had interest in science and math and technology. And of course, that led me into an engineering education, as you mentioned. After getting my undergrad degree, went to work full-time in chemical plants, spent 15 years in chemical plants as a process engineer, a little bit of time in health and safety, but wound up as an operations manager. It's my final role at an operating site. And that was over 15 years and three different states, three different companies and multiple sites within that. So I have some exposure to a lot of different things, and being somebody who appreciates continuous learning and getting to know different processes, it was a great environment to be a part of. As you mentioned, during that time, did the Six Sigma certification to add on to my process engineering skills, and also did the MBA at nights to try and build that business acumen and background. After working in operating sites for that amount of time, I moved on to corporate roles, first at a multinational fiberglass solutions business, and there was a business level black belt and worked on leading maintenance excellence across eight international sites, and was also part of a team that was focused on energy conservation at those sites as well. And as part of that work, I received two U.S. patents on how to get multiple uses out of energy. So have that little plus on my resume as well. After being there for a couple of years, I moved into leading operational excellence for a salt and fertilizer company. Spent over a decade there building our OE culture from nothing to something that saved us $160 million over the course of 10 years. And that included initial development of our lean house, our training, our execution of projects, coaching people on projects, tracking our progress, and leading that whole effort, and also building networks within the company so we could steal shamelessly from one another across that enterprise. So did that, as I said, for over a decade. And then, as is often the case nowadays in the corporate world, had multiple management changes. And so it was time to go do something different, where I wasn't at the mercy of whatever whim we had at the in the C-suite. I bet on myself, started my consultancy about 5 years ago. And it was really to apply the same skills that I brought to my companies and focus on small and medium-sized companies who have the same issues the large companies have, but may not have the bandwidth or the skill set to attack them. That enabled me to go out and work with a number of different industries, which I hadn't had prior experience with, many that you mentioned in the intro. You know, going from heavy industry to toll packaging, logistics, worked with an agricultural cooperative earlier this year on some of their process work, insurance, done a lot of work around insurance and insurance processing, and even hospitality. So, and the cool thing when you have this kind of exposure is you see a lot of similarities across all these businesses of the issues they face, even though they're doing vastly different things. So coming in from an outside viewpoint, helping them work through the issues they have in a structured way, you can really pull all that experience together when you're helping clients in that fashion.
Yeah, that's the amazing part when we do have so much experience. And I am going to turn a little bit to the CEOs, founders, and presidents out there, especially as small and medium-sized businesses. There is so much talent out there, such as Dan and myself. Don't be afraid to ask for help. We can come in and drop in for a couple hours a week. We can stay and be interim leadership. But I bring people like Dan onto the show to introduce them to my audience. And even if you're an up-and-coming leader, not yet made it to the C-suite, knowing people like Dan or others that I bring on the show, you never know when you're going to need such expertise. So I'm grateful to know you because I have a few operational excellence people in my back pocket. I know as I scale and my clients need help, I can rely on you. But there's so much, and you shared just about everything right now. I was just curious, when you decided to start your own business, because I always go there. I've been in my business for 5 years. Tell me about it. Easy, hard, still trying to figure it out.
All that, yes.
Okay.
The most challenging thing is trying to connect with those clients who have those needs. You've probably found that in your business as well. The easy part is knowing what you have the skills to do. It's connecting with people who are struggling. They know they have issues. They don't know how to address them. And so it's making those connections to the marketplace, trying to identify clients, making sure, first of all, they have a need you can fulfill. Because I think right up front, one of the big questions is, you know, for a leader is, what is impeding your business progress? What do you need to do to get better? And defining that problem is always a challenge for folks. So once we have kind of an initial conversation, it may lead to more questions around, okay, what would it mean to your company if you increased throughput by 10% or reduced your costs by 5%? What would that mean you could do in the future that you can't do today? Getting to a point where you can have those conversations is probably the biggest challenge for somebody who started a business. As a lot of us do, it starts with referrals and knowing people who have worked with you in the past or maybe in different roles and know your skill set. Once you get beyond that point, because I'm at a point in my career where a lot of those leaders are now retired. So it's going out and finding a new set of leaders to interact with and build up that rapport and trust, because you can't do anything if those folks you're working with don't know they can count on you.
The other thing I was thinking about as you were talking is trying to find out what makes you distinct and different. Again, I talk to my listeners so often, highly talented people, mostly still in a corporate role, even the C-suite leaders. And you know, when it comes to relying on your network, maybe you're looking for a promotion, maybe you are looking for that next gig in your own profession. What makes you different? And we're going to continue this interview unless you say, Deb, I've got my 10-second elevator pitch. This is how I'm different. But I want to listen to you as we go through this conversation, because I know I am going to hear something I've never heard before when it comes to an operational excellence professional that I'll say, ah, Dan's that guy. So we're going to glean that out throughout this here. But what I wanted to know is operational excellence. Leaders starting to feel a little uncomfortable. They may have been told they need to fix things, or they may have something in their gut that says, I got to fix things. And I'm just curious about, are there industries or types of people that are most receptive to hearing your thoughts and asking the right questions? And maybe are there industries that they're very resistant? I'm just wondering, you know, are there demographics of people that are highly aware and those that say, yeah, it's just another program and I'll just go around with it? So maybe tell me a little bit more about that, because I'm always looking to try to break through the mindset.
I don't know if there's any set demographic of people who are either open or somewhat resistant to change. Sometimes you connect with people who are just at the right point. So they may have been trying to do the same thing or throwing more money at the problem to amplify that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in one of those loops where no matter what amount of money you're throwing at a problem, it just doesn't get better, or you think you've fixed the problem, but it keeps coming back. Those are the types of people who hopefully the light bulb's starting to go off and they think, okay, well, I need to do something different. And that something different may be getting an outside perspective. I like to say, and people in my network that I work with like to say, it's tough to read the label if you're inside the jar. And so coming in with that outside perspective and having seen similar issues in either at different sites or different industries is something that management consultants bring to the table, provided we have a reasonable amount of experience. I think there's the flip side where if you have people who are just learning, you know, the good advantage with people who have decades of experience, they've done all the mistakes already and you don't have to pay for those if you're a leader seeking help. So if you're in that loop, it probably makes sense to have a conversation with somebody who's outside the immediate issue, even if it's just a 15-minute conversation to try and get some outside perspective.
Yeah,
that may lead to, hey, I think I can work with this person, or it may lead to, I don't think I want to explore that anymore with that person. Those are the kind of two extreme options. But it's recognition of that problem not going away and then thinking maybe I need to do something different. And so one example I have of that is I joined my last large corporation to build an operational excellence program. But as we were getting that started, we had a large site that was struggling with maintaining their equipment and being able to reliably deliver product over time. And they had just been continuously throwing more people, more money at it. And the issue was, I can build a great reactive system and throw more money at it, but I'm never going to fix what's really causing the issue that's going to keep, you know, it's basically on this flywheel kind of approach. The tough thing as part of that is oftentimes you have to still manage that old reactive process while you're building the new process. So you have to do two things at once to change the culture. And so it's recognizing that there's this hump to go over and there's a time to it. So having somebody who's been through that before is important to help guide you through that. I was fortunate we had a couple of leaders at that site who knew they weren't fixing it by throwing more money and more people at it. And they had to sit down and kind of think through, what are we going to do different? So I went in, helped them understand what a proactive asset reliability process would look like, was there on the ground as a coach through that process. We brought in some external resource to help build our work management, make sure we had systems behind the scenes that were also supporting that approach to get us to a point where we could kind of keep our head above water, free up some resource to do some of the proactive work. And I know this gets very technical very quickly. In essence, what we were trying to do was figure out something had broken before our human senses could detect it. In a big industrial facility, you have a point of failure, which is oftentimes months ahead of when you can hear it, see it, feel it. You know, if a bearing's getting hot, it usually had an issue probably 2 or 3 months before. So it's building up that ability and technology to go figure that out and then schedule that repair ahead of things getting crazy. Usually they don't fail at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. They fail at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night. And so it's a challenge because if you don't have the parts, you don't have the people to fix it, be back up and running, because in these continuous manufacturing operations, you make the money by running all the time. So going through that cultural change, putting together a team, going through change management, you know, the basic steps of change management, what's our burning platform? What are the 3 to 5 things we're going to do immediately to work on it? And then probably most important for selling that change is the what's in it for me factor for the people doing the work, be those operators or maintainers, be that the storeroom, be that the management team. If we're going to take on this effort and know we have to go over the hump, what happens when we're over the hump? How does my life change? Is it worth the pain to get there? And so we were able to, at the end of that process, and it was months to years to make that go, we were able to flip the amount of time we spent reacting to break fix issues with the amount of time we were now spending on detecting failures and fixing failures before they took our plant down. So just an interesting challenge to work through with both people, process, and throw some technology in behind there to help make it go as well.
So I appreciate that story because one of the things that I take away from it, I actually have 2 points, but one of them is the fact that when you talk about what's in it for me, the very and probably most important component is when we think about operational excellence, if we don't really qualify the change and what's in it for me, people start getting scared, they resist, and then they say, you know, they're not buying in and they're just being difficult. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to do, again, some highly aware leaders realize I've been throwing money at this. You may still need to invest, but it's about repurposing the people and the resources on what they'll be doing, going from a reactive activity-based work to the detection and the proactive work. And then where are you allocating those funds? Maybe there is a better piece of equipment to detect things, sense things farther upstream where maybe a human cannot see it because maybe it's a closed system or something. So once we get over that concept, nobody's going to lose their job, but you are going to grow and learn and be doing something and saving the company money eventually. So it's a little bit of a mindset shift and you have to spend a little bit of extra time explaining to the people how life may be actually better.
And I think to go along with that, making sure you had representation from each one of those functional groups as part of that team, because you needed emissaries to go back. This was a plant with several hundred people, so you couldn't have everybody on the team, but you needed to have key people who could understand that change management and could relay it back to their teammates to help get everybody on board, because we needed to all row the boat in the same direction.
I'm smiling here because, you know, we as operational excellence professionals can learn our craft. We know how to form teams. We know how to do project charters and get stakeholders involved and measurement systems and all of that stuff. And one of the biggest mistakes I made, I was actually working on my lean black belt, was I assemble the people. We're starting to discuss the issues. What actions can we take? And then we send the engineer to the floor to make the adjustments to see if we made the incremental improvement. And then on third shift, the operators are starting to change the setting backs. And we come back to our meeting and said, what happened? And those operators, they changed the settings back. And then I realized, oh my God, I forgot to include production people because they may have a say as to, no, that's not the right setting, or communicating and enforcing and supporting the evaluation of the change you want. So we have 30, 35 years experience of making mistakes and knowing what not to do to help such leaders be able to move forward successfully.
Yes, absolutely. Take advantage of our history. We've done the failures for you, so you don't have to.
I wanted to take a moment to remind you that a recent study showed nearly 60% of leaders feel depleted at the end of the day. And this feeling is a key indicator of burnout and makes it difficult to lead and inspire others. If you've ever experienced that restless exhaustion, you know why CEOs are amongst the most likely candidates for experiencing job frustration. I wrote The CEO's Compass, Your Guide to Get Back on Track, to confront those feelings and create a plan that is sustainable for you and your organization. I created a 7-point assessment that will help you figure out your problems in days, not months. And it includes so many resources, worksheets, videos, and much, much more. If this is you, please head over to my website, dropinceo.com, and click on my products, The CEO's Compass, and order yours on Amazon or other outlets. And now back to the conversation.
So I'm going to go in a different direction. This is also in your bio. 2 daughters, have gone into engineering. That is unheard of. First of all, a lot of women don't necessarily think that they're qualified or want to pursue that endeavor. You have two fine women in your family that have pursued engineering. And Dad does engineering too. So how did that happen? What inspired them along the way? I'm just curious because I think you should buy a lottery ticket with that.
Well, actually, I have to, for full disclosure, I have to say I have three women engineers in my family because
beautiful.
I'm married to a chemical engineer with an MBA as well.
Oh, wow.
So it wasn't just Dad's influence, it was Mom's influence.
Beautiful.
And Mom is running a large ag products facility as a site director. There's always been that example. One interesting thing is up until the point where I launched my own consultancy, my wife and I had worked together for over 25 years at the different companies we'd joined.
How did that work out? You're still together.
It was all, you know, it's all, you know, proving your capability and making sure you have great connections. So we were able to move and do different roles at different companies that complemented our skill set. So my girls always had that example for them in front of them. I think we recognized pretty early with my oldest that she was very process-oriented, problem solver. One of the things we did when she was in high school is we sent her to a week-long summer engineering program at the Missouri School of Science and Technology. The real purpose there was to help her figure out, she knew she wanted to do engineering, she just didn't know what type. Mm. And so she got exposed to the major types of engineering, and she wound up, like Mom and Dad, wanting to do chemical engineering and process work. So now she's employed by a large pharma company doing process development, you know, a year out of school and really enjoying that. And my younger daughter, who's the rebel, is a biomedical engineering student finishing up her junior year, but has decided she's going to take a fifth year master's as part of that to extend her technical education and hopefully make her a bit more valuable to the marketplace. But she's really enjoying that. And I think the aspects of that program and how at the end of the day it helps people. So it's mm-hmm. a technological solution that helps people either by building the machines that you interact with in a healthcare facility, or if you happen to have a prosthetic or something implanted in your body, at the end of the day, it's helping people have a healthier lifestyle. So there's some, I think, some very positive human aspects to the technical side. I think my daughters saw good career options. They saw things they were interested in. They saw things that they see themselves building a career around. I think they also see adaptability. My wife and I, as we moved around, this is state number 6 for me and state number 7 for my wife. So you know if you have the right skill set, it can be adapted to multiple situations. You can have flexibility. So when I talk to young people or up-and-coming leaders, that's the sort of thing, you know, it's finding something you enjoy that you think you can build a career out of. It's having adaptability. If you look at the average career, it probably changes 6 to 10 times in your lifetime now. So making sure you have skills that can adapt to that. Another piece of that, which we haven't discussed directly, is as you're going through that career, it's finding that team to work with. And it can be a focus team fixing things as part of an improvement project. It can be an extended network. So I know that as I'm working with networks of other professionals to help solve problems for clients. Oftentimes, that group has different skills than I do. It's great to have that network to go out and say, hey, I need somebody who is a financial expert or a sales and marketing expert, or somebody who's been a CEO in the past and can come in and offer some high-level advice. And having that network out there to help when you're out working with these small companies that, as I mentioned earlier, all have problems. They might not have the expertise and experience, but as we mentioned earlier, you use other people's mistakes to avoid them yourself if you can.
And that is why we have these podcast interviews. Yes, we are providing value for our listeners, but it also gives me an opportunity to get to know you as part of a network of process improvement professionals, because I may have my Lean and Six Sigma black belt just like you, but there are smarter people than me. I know enough when I go into an organization that we need some help. I may know what kind of help, but then I may not be the right person to oversee and make sure they're successful. So again, I am so appreciative that I have gotten the chance to meet you. And I really love your points there about the adaptability and enjoying your work. So many people pigeonhole themselves into like a silo of a particular industry, or I can only go up so far. If you really, really love your craft, sell yourself based on your value and the problems that you've solved, and separate yourself from the industry. The industry provides some really cool examples and stories to tell to represent your value. And engineering, continuous improvement is very, very transferable. Shameless plug to pursue this kind of work.
Yeah, I think one of the other points I'd like to emphasize, and I think we touched on it a bit when we were talking about teams and problem solving. And this goes back to one of my mentors. I worked for him at three different companies. We obviously had a strong connection, very similar backgrounds. He worked for large multinational chemical and processing companies. But he had a great down-to-earth way about him and was able to balance business needs with respect for people. And I think getting the people closest to the work when we're trying to solve these problems is so important. Getting them involved, and back to your operator example, those are the people doing the work. They have observations, and there's a what's in it for me for them. A story he often related to me was, you know, whenever he'd go into a new facility, he would find the grumpiest person there running the operation and try and win that person over, because his feeling was there's something there. That person tried to do things better at some point and was shut down in the past. So how do we flip that person and make them feel valued again and make them get engaged as part of trying to make things better? And you might not win all those battles. At the least, you know where you stand with the person who maybe is that outlier and can use that to help drive the organization along. And so I know when I'm working with teams, any site I'm at, it's having those conversations with the people closest to the work, understanding their observation. They might not have the technical background to fully explain what's going on, but they know what they see and they know what they feel, and they know that if they change something, they know what the outcome will be. So getting those people engaged is so important if you're going to do any sort of lasting improvement.
So at the beginning of the interview, I said I was going to try to understand what distinguishes you from the rest. And mind you, every person that I meet on this podcast, they're pleasant. We have a great conversation. But very distinctly, what jumps out at me is you have a very positive persona. Again, sometimes when we come as consultants or technical leaders, we can be a little bit dry, could be a little bit professorial, you know, spouting their knowledge, and we can implement this and we can implement that. And sometimes you feel below them. But for those of you who are going to see this on the YouTube video, hopefully, and just by listening, you have such a positive persona. You just come into the room, it's like, okay, we got a problem. Let's start talking to the people. Let's just start doing stuff instantaneously. I can feel a sense of reassurance. It may be a challenge. It may be a debacle. We may be losing money, but I feel good because Dan is so positive.
The other thing we bring as people coming in from the outside, unless we're coming into the exact environment we've worked in the past, we may be expert at the problem-solving process, but we're not expert at their process. The experts are in the room.
Right.
And so it's reinforcing that with the team and making sure it's very important for me, though it might not be coming through at an interview because this is how it's designed. I want to talk the least amount I can when I go into those situations. I want to pull the information out of the people who know what's going on and build a solution that whole group can stand behind.
And that's the best comment that you've made in this entire interview. I love it. I love it. So Dan, it's a very good name. My husband's named Dan and my son is named Danny. So very wonderful name. I have so enjoyed getting to know you. And I feel like I now have a trusted partner from this, my major network, you know, in the area of operational excellence. But I'm going to just give you the floor one last time in case there are any last closing thoughts or actionable tips for our audience and maybe for people to get a hold of you if they want to learn more about your work.
Sure. I think it's critical for leaders to make sure they spend time defining the problem they're trying to fix, and go through that churn up front and don't treat a symptom. So it's knowing what you're really after and having that discipline to work through that definition and make sure you're laying it out, you're able to show the process in a way that's visual and the team can understand, and then working through the root cause process. You've had a 5Y or a fishbone, whatever the case, you know, all those technical tools, but it's really making sure at the end of the day, you're treating the family of causes, not treating the symptoms that you see. That's really what structured problem solving is all about at a high level, whatever that problem is. If people are interested in getting in touch with me, I'm open to chat. I have on my website, which is Lakehurst Consulting, L-A-K-E-H-U-R-S-T, consulting, all one word, .com. My contact information is out there. I'm also very active on LinkedIn. And so I'm Daniel A. Pinkham Jr. on LinkedIn, if people want to search and connect with me there. You know, I'm always sharing content and ideas and love to get into conversations with people on their perspective on an issue or maybe how I'm wrong, because that's how I learn.
So, Dan, it has been an amazing conversation. I want to thank you for dropping in on the podcast, and I want to wish you well and your family much success and be well.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Deb.
Thank you for listening to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I hope you are inspired by our conversation and can apply what you heard to your business or career goals. If you found this valuable, please share this show with at least one friend who will find it useful and inspiring. When you share this podcast, it allows me to continue to help C-suite leaders of today and tomorrow to navigate their challenges with confidence. To connect with me or learn more about the Drop-In CEO services, go to my website at dropinceo.com. And until we meet, I wish you well and much success.